Our next guest on Downtown is journalist and author of books, including Pictures at a Revolution, Five Came Back, and his wonderful new biography, Mike Nichols, A Life. Pleased to welcome to the show author Mark Harris. There's so much to take in this wonderful book about Mike Nichols, and there's a mythology about him, much of it self-created. I think of the line from The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. Was it difficult for you to separate the two?
Yeah, absolutely it was, because of course my goal was to try to print the fact, not the legend, while acknowledging the fact that there is a legend around him, because, you know, the story of the making of The Graduate and how he rose out of an early career as a performer with Elaine May to have this extraordinary pivot to being a director has a lot of kind of myth attached to it now. So I really tried to pull the truth apart from the fabrication.
I'm curious about some of the logistics here. Your research is so extensive. I'm curious how you organized everything. Did you do it thematically? Did you put together a timeline?
I put together a timeline. That is always the way I work. I just create this document, which eventually becomes unwieldy and huge, that includes everything I read, everything I see, every person I talk to, every quote I find. And I try to put it in some chronological order, because I can't understand for myself why things happen until I understand when they happen. And I have found that the deeper you dig into the when, the more some of the why becomes apparent. You start understanding, like, oh, he was in this mental place because this thing had just happened, and that's why he made this strange decision. So yeah, I always work with a timeline.
Did it add any pressure, or was it a level of comfort because you did know him personally?
I don't think it added comfort. I think it was complicated, because I had known Mike for the last, I guess, 12 to 14 years of his life. And so I did wonder, for the years that I was researching the book, what am I going to do when I get to the chapter where there are things I know, not because I researched them, but because I was there. I got to know Mike when my husband, Tony Kushner, and he worked together on the HBO adaptation of Angels in America. And so right around 2000, 2001, I sort of come into the story. But I found that while I was doing the research and while I was interviewing people, my journalistic instinct sort of took over, and the part of me that knew him was left aside. He was just really someone I was trying to figure out. And of course, I realized that since this was a 35 chapter book ultimately, and I only come in at chapter 32, that what I didn't know was much, much greater than what I did know.
Well, as you point out, he was the outsider who became the ultimate insider, but he never seemed to lose the need to prove himself. How much of that was because of a keen awareness of his own flaws, from the physical issues to his seemingly a nearly lifelong struggle controlling his anger?
I think Mike had a lot to deal with. You know, as you mentioned, he started life really as an outsider. He and his family escaped Berlin just before World War II and resettled in New York. Mike had a bad reaction to a vaccine when he was 4, and as a result, lost all his hair and was bald as a child. And so when you start out in a new country and a kind of unforgiving place, not sounding like anyone else and not looking like anyone else, and then sliding into poverty after the death of his father, which happened when Mike was just 12 or 13, you know, I think what that left him with was not just a desire to prove himself, but an understanding of how fragile and transient safety and security could be. I think Mike did get angry on sets occasionally, but what sort of impresses me is that he realized very early on that was not only a problem, but the wrong thing to do. And he spent a lot of his life really trying to become a better person than he felt he had been early in his career.
Obviously, you can't tell the story of Mike Nichols without talking about Elaine May. And I love Mike Nichols' description. He said that we were both seductive, both on the defensive.
Right. That Mike and Elaine met each other when they were about 20 years old. So he's talking about a really specific time in the 1950s in Chicago when he was kind of out in the world for the first time on his own and had created this kind of scary external persona. They were both known as someone who could completely cut anyone down just with a well-turned sentence. And at the same time, they met each other and had this instant deep, deep bond where they realized that they sort of needed each other in their lives and that they were kind of meant to know each other and ultimately meant to work together. And that led to their performing partnership, which lasted probably 7 or 8 years. And then it broke up in a kind of acrimonious way. And there was a brief rift, but they stayed in each other's lives as friends and often as collaborators for Mike's entire life. That, you know, he knew her for more than 60 years.
And it was Elaine May who convinced him that every scene was one of only three things.
Right. She said every scene, because their whole specialty was doing these 5 or 10 minute things that began as improvs but turned into their best loved comedy routines. She said every scene should be either a seduction, a negotiation, or a fight. And when in doubt, seduce. And I think from that, Mike learned not only a lot about how to be a performer, but a lot about telling stories and a lot about pacing and a lot about shaping a dramatic or comedic moment that probably served him really well all the way through his life as a director.
And their rise to fame was so swift and incredible. And I think he mentions along the way in the book that's something you couldn't possibly be prepared for and that affected him through him in a sense, maybe more than anything else that happened in his professional career.
Yeah, I think it's hard for people now in 2021 to understand a world in which you literally could become famous overnight just by one well-timed, very effective appearance on a TV show. But that is what happened to Nichols and May. They had been rising steadily. You know, they'd come to New York. They became a very successful club act at a time when, you know, nightclub culture was still a thing. But then in early 1958, they appeared on a variety sketch show called Omnibus. It was a 2-hour special and they just had two sketches. And they really were famous instantly. I mean, we were in a world with only three major networks back then. And so tens of millions of people saw them and suddenly everybody wanted to know who they were and where they had come from. And as Elaine May said, we thought nobody would get us. And it turned out that everybody got us.
We're talking with Mark Harris about his book, Mike Nichols, A Life. Elaine May grew tired of essentially repeating lines. She wanted every performance to be something brand new. Mike Nichols was more comfortable with the way things were going, but eventually they decided to part ways professionally, and Mike got the opportunity to become a director. And as you point out, it became apparent to him almost immediately that this was his calling.
Yeah, it was very interesting to learn that Mike didn't really like himself all that much as the person he became when he was performing. The high point of Nichols and May's performing career together was that they did a Broadway show, and the show was a huge success. It was one of those, you know, Hamilton-like shows that everybody had to see, and it ran for about 8 months. And during that time, it really became clear that Elaine was not happy doing the same material verbatim night after night after night. It was never what either of them had bargained for, but he was more comfortable with it than she was. So their partnership ended. They tried another situation where she wrote a play and he acted in it, and that really drove a wedge between them, and that play never even came to New York. And then he sort of backed into directing almost because he couldn't figure out what else to do. And so he was offered a chance to try to direct a Neil Simon play. And Neil Simon was not yet in any way famous. And Mike did say that the second he walked into the rehearsal room, he thought, oh, this is what I'm meant to do, because being the director is like being the father. And that's what I want to be, which is a sort of extraordinary thing to feel when you're only 31 or 32 years old.
And recently I've seen some commentary on social media from people who pick out one moment in the book, and it's the scene working on Barefoot in the Park with Elizabeth Ashley when she's kind of lost and not quite sure what to do. And he takes her face in his hands and says, essentially, just be the girl that, that everyone wants. And people have kind of hammered that as a critique of Nichols, but to me, they miss the rest of that chapter of the book where she goes on to explain that she never would have survived that run. And she'd had a breakdown along the way. And if it hadn't been for Mike Nichols' kindness, she might have never made it through.
Yeah, well, that's very true. And what's slightly frustrating about that story is that it's really only the first half of the story. I mean, Mike did say, you know, be the girl. You're the girl every man wants. You're the girl every girl wants to be. And what Elizabeth Ashley said, quite rightly, was, I can't play that. That's not a character. Right. And I think it's to Mike's huge credit, because of course this was 1963, that he listened to her and he realized that that was not a sufficient piece of direction. And so he started working with her more specifically and giving her the kind of guidance that he became famous for giving actors. And it was through that work that she developed what was widely said to be a fantastic performance. So Mike does not fit the mold of someone who was sort of dismissive or patronizing to women. That story starts out one way, but it ends in a very different place.
Absolutely. And his directorial style was built around storytelling, helping actors discover the truth. I think he referred to it as, or maybe it was you, as a self-revelation as anecdote.
Right. Yes. I mean, that's what I said. He loved to tell stories about himself, as sometimes as a way of loosening up an actor, sometimes as a way of telling a story about a feeling that would point them toward the feeling that he wanted them to have in the scene. He really loved using analogy, sometimes to draw them out and help them find a thing in their own life that they could connect to. But you know, one of the things he said was that he thought the job of a director was a kind of two-pronged thing, that every director had to think in terms of staging a scene, what is it really like when this happens? What is it like? And the other thing a director always has to keep in mind is what happens next. So the first of those things is, in a way, how do you make it real? And the second thing is, how do you keep the story going? And those two things were really his hallmark as a director.
One of the things he did to make it real, and I was fascinated reading about this as an actor, was his use of stage business, giving actors things to do and getting away from what was really a very presentational style of acting, where actors would almost face the audience to nail those punchlines. But he had his actors working, doing things, and sometimes that meant not even looking at each other while saying their lines, and that added so much to that naturalness.
Right. I mean, there's a famous thing about The Odd Couple, which is the Neil Simon play that he directed in its first appearance on Broadway. And The Odd Couple begins for like the first 35 or 40 minutes with a poker game on stage. And that is kind of a director's nightmare, because first of all, you never want to have to put people at a round table, because it means somebody's back is going to be to the audience. Second, you never want people just sitting there, not moving. And so Mike kind of took that scene apart line by line and beat by beat. And it wasn't just business that he came up with, because to him, it wasn't business. It was, who are these people and how are they going to manifest who they are by what they do, by how they eat a sandwich, by how they reach across someone else to get chips or to get some food, by how they turn to each other, by how they lean back. I mean, he really wanted to show you character through action as much as through the lines. And so that scene, as he ended up staging it, was considered a kind of masterpiece of staging, and really was one of the things that built his already growing reputation as a director who could make anything come alive on stage.
Well, and he had that great early success with Barefoot in the Park, and then for his first film, ends up taking on the most acclaimed play of the decade in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and so many remarkable stories around the making of that film. I love the story about him getting together with Jack Warner and trying to convince him to shoot the film in black and white.
Right. Not only trying to convince him, but succeeding. I mean, there was still a little bit of black and white being used in 1965, which is when this film was shot. But really, everyone was moving toward color because they didn't want black and white. By then was becoming this thing that was associated with old movies and with television. And Mike really felt the movie had to be black and white because, first of all, at the time, as odd as it sounds, black and white was the hallmark of serious adult drama. Mm. But also, they had Elizabeth Taylor, who was only 32 years old and very beautiful, playing this kind of alcoholic, overweight wreck of a 48-year-old woman. And he felt that the makeup in color would not hold up, that he could do it convincingly in black and white, but he couldn't do it in color. So it was really important, and Jack Warner, the head of Warner Brothers, opposed him. And Nichols's attitude, and this is sort of amazing because it was his first movie and he was not even, 35 years old yet, was, I don't have to do this. I'll go home. I'll go back to New York. I have a very nice career directing theater and I'll just keep doing that. And that kind of, as he himself said, snottiness and indifference really in that very first movie helped him get his way.
And that opportunity in many ways, a product of, I guess, what he would ascribe to luck, but the fact that he had become friends with Richard Burton when Camelot was in the theater, I think at the Majestic next door to where Nichols and May were doing their show, he ended up, going to Italy and squiring around Elizabeth Taylor while Burton was shooting. And so they already had that established relationship, and it was because Taylor and Burton wanted him that the studio was convinced to give him that opportunity.
Yeah, it was a kind of funny multi-step dance where Nichols got to know Burton. Through Burton, he got to know Taylor. Then Taylor, but not Burton, was signed for Virginia Woolf. Mike used his relationship with Elizabeth Taylor to get that directing job, and Warner's gave him the directing job because the studio thought, if we give it to him, maybe Burton, who really likes him, will come along. And they knew that, as great as it was having Elizabeth Taylor, if they had Taylor and Burton together in a story about a crazy marriage, they would have not just a movie, but a real event. And in a way, that ended up with one unintended side effect, which is it really empowered Mike in a way that no first-time director would ordinarily experience, because Warner Brothers knew that they couldn't fire him or discipline him as long as Taylor and Burton, who they desperately needed, had his back. And they really did have his back.
And then he had to call on another friend, Jacqueline Kennedy, to try and make sure that the Legion of Decency didn't shoot down the film and refuse to give it its stamp of approval.
Right. I mean, this is the last moment in movie history when American movies faced anything like a code of censorship. The movie had to pass the production code, which was the secular film industry office that governed the content of movies. But also, if a movie didn't get the approval of what was then called the National Catholic Office of Motion Pictures, but really everyone knew as the Legion of Decency, there were a lot of theaters where it couldn't play. There were a lot of cities where it couldn't play. And Virginia Woolf was going to be a really tough call because there was language in that movie. Remember, this is before the rating system existed. There was language in that movie that had never been heard in a studio movie before. And so Nichols convinced Warner Brothers, which had fired him off of the, they kicked him out of the editing room by then, to let him back in the editing room by saying that he would get Jacqueline Kennedy to go sit there as all the Monsignors and members of the Catholic board watched the movie. And when the movie was over, she would say very audibly, "Oh, what a wonderful movie." Jack would have loved it. And Nichols felt that that would have been, you know, an unmistakable signal to the board to approve the movie. And in fact, that's exactly what happened.
We're talking with Mark Harris here on Downtown. You had written extensively about The Graduate in your wonderful book, Pictures at a Revolution. Was that a help or a hindrance when you came to that part of the Mike Nichols story?
It was a huge hindrance. It was there were a couple of parts of the book I was really dreading, and one, which we talked about earlier, was as I said, Angels in America, which is where I come in. But the other was The Graduate, because I thought I had done a pretty definitive job of telling that story in my first book. And of course, I thought, you know, I can't assume that anybody has read that book, and I need to, you know, come at the story fresh and tell it as if I hadn't told it before, and maybe even find some new ways to tell it. And I was worried about that part when I was writing, partly because there really was no more research that I could do on it. I had talked to everyone who was around. I had done everything I could. So I ended up just reading through my notes, particularly the old notes about Mike and his work on it, and telling it slightly more from the perspective of this is where he was coming from in his career and this is where he was heading. And I think people seem to like The Graduate chapter, so I'm very relieved to know that.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the great takeaways from it is that this movie that so many point to as the start of really creating the voice of a new generation, that's not what Mike Nichols saw in The Graduate at all. It was, to him, a sex comedy about a young guy and an older woman.
That is what he thought when he started it. And I think then he realized that it could be a little bit more than that, but he certainly did not see it as a generation gap movie. I mean, he thought there was something very contemporary in it, in that he thought the story of Benjamin was really the story of a very, very privileged young man who came home to California and found himself absolutely drowning in the materialism and the sort of capitalist ethos of his parents, and so tried to escape into this kind of nihilistic affair with Mrs. Robinson, and then finally figured out what he wanted. That's what he thought the story was about, but he didn't realize that that Benjamin was going to be taken as a kind of youth hero. And neither did Dustin Hoffman, by the way, who was 30 when he played the part of this 21 or 22-year-old guy. They were very, very surprised when they went to the first preview of the movie in New York and saw the audience from the balcony stand up and start to cheer and yell when Benjamin breaks up the wedding at the end and runs away with Elaine. That's when they knew that they might have something that was bigger than they thought it was going to be, because they didn't have huge expectations for The Graduate. After all, it wasn't even made by a studio. It was made by an independent company. It starred someone who no one had ever heard of. And by the end of its run, it was the third highest grossing movie in U.S. history up to that point.
We talked to Bill Daniels on the show a couple of years ago, and he was telling us that the producers weren't sure he was old enough to play Benjamin's father, and then it didn't go quite the way he expected. His part ended up being much smaller than he originally envisioned it.
Yeah, I don't think any of the actors really necessarily knew that it was going to work the way it did. I mean, Bill Daniels, I know, was very disappointed that a couple of his big scenes were cut out. The Graduate is not a long movie. You know, it's only about an hour and 45 minutes. Nichols really pared it down to absolutely what was needed. And I think some of the actors were kind of shocked by its tone, were kind of shocked by its style. It didn't look like other comedies of the mid-1960s, but you know, it didn't take them long to realize The Graduate opened at the very end of 1967. It took off at the box office instantly. It made a whole bunch of 10 best lists. It got a raft of Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, nominations for all three of the main actors, and then for Nichols, who won his Oscar for Best Directing for that movie.
so much of Mike Nichols' work explored what I think we could call the failings of traditional masculinity. In some ways, even The Odd Couple, Streamers, certainly The Graduate, Carnal Knowledge. Was he also in that work trying to answer questions about himself?
I think Mike would probably say that he was trying to answer questions about himself, but he would also say and said frequently that you don't always know why you're making a movie. Sometimes you just know that you want to make it or you feel you need to make it. I mean, one thing he said, and I think he said this about The Graduate, is the movie you're making, or no, I'm sorry, he said it about Silkwood, of all things, but he said the movie you're making always turns out to be about you on some level, but that you might not understand the specific way it's about you for years after it comes out. And that was certainly true for The Graduate. He said he didn't really have a sense that Benjamin was him, that Benjamin was the outsider in a world of happy, cheerful Americans. He didn't even really understand why he had cast someone like Dustin Hoffman instead of, say, Robert Redford, who really wanted that part, and who, like, as unlikely as it feels now for Robert Redford to be in The Graduate, if you read the novel that The Graduate is based on, the way the character is described is much closer to Redford than it is to Dustin Hoffman. He's a track star. He goes and fights forest fires. So it was Nichols's instinct to cast Hoffman, but he didn't know why. And I think one of the remarkable things about Mike Nichols as a director is he understood that you didn't always have to know why you were making the creative decisions you were making. Sometimes you just had to let your subconscious rule.
Even long before The Birdcage, he seemed very comfortable with presenting gay characters, not as caricatures, generally in an honest fashion. Where did that sensibility come from?
I think it was probably an outsider sensibility. I mean, certainly growing up in New York and then in the Chicago theater scene and then in the New York theater scene, Mike would have been exposed to gay people as colleagues, as friends, as acquaintances. They were just part of the fabric of the life of someone who lived the way he lived. And there was no, Mike was not defensive or anxious about his own masculinity. He was very comfortable with who he was, and so, yeah, it's really the same, in the same way that Mike was much more interested in women as collaborators and colleagues and much more willing to listen to them than a lot of his contemporaries were. He was comfortable with gay characters. He was interested in gay characters. His position about gay people sort of evolved over time, as everyone's position of his generation did. But they show up a lot, and they show up a lot in his stage work, too. Streamers, a really famous production he did in 1977, has a homosexual subplot and theme that was quite unusual then. He was at ease with things that a lot of other directors were not at ease with.
Everybody in life tends to learn more from failure than success, and he certainly found a way to pivot after failures. As you did your research, was there maybe one film or one stage production that didn't go as well as planned that you found especially illuminating in how it affected his artistic approach going forward?
Yeah, there were actually many of them. I mean, I spend a good deal of time in the book on Mike's failures, because I think they're really important means of understanding him. But probably the most important one, I think, was his first one, which was that after The Graduate, he directed the movie version of Catch 22. And, this was the first time when his success as a movie director was so widely known that it affected the way he was treated. He was given a much, much bigger budget. The sky was the limit in terms of how elaborate he wanted the staging to be. He had this huge cast at his command, everyone from Alan Arkin in the lead role to Orson Welles, who was there for 2 weeks. you know, the movie took an incredibly long time to make, and I think there are some really interesting things about it. It's very much worth seeing, but 3 months before it was scheduled to open, MASH opened.
Right.
And the minute Mike Nichols saw that movie, he realized not only was his movie doomed, but that MASH was really more the kind of movie he wished he had made than Catch-22 was. And out of that failure, because the movie, you know, didn't get any Oscar nominations and did lose a good deal of money and wasn't very well reviewed. What Mike learned from that was, he said, when you have a big failure like that, the first thing he learned was, I'll survive. I mean, he had been waiting and waiting for his first failure, and now he unmistakably had it. But the second thing was, he said, I think the thing I need to do is go do something small that I don't think has very good commercial prospects, but just do it because I really love it. And that turned out to be Carnal Knowledge, which ended up being a big critical hit and quite a commercial success too. So that was a lesson that that Mike, you know, reapplied over and over again. It wasn't a lesson that would prevent you from having a failure, but it was a great coping strategy for once you did have a failure. And many, many times throughout the rest of his career, you can see that some of his most interesting work comes right after something has gone really wrong in his career.
In light of that, is there one film in particular that you wish people would give a second viewing to?
I would like people to take another look at a movie that really got kicked around critically when it opened, which was Heartburn, his comedy with Meryl Streep that's based on the breakup of the marriage of Nora Ephron and Carl Bernstein. That film had a troubled production, and when it was reviewed very much in the context of the fact that the leading man of the movie, Mandy Patinkin, had been replaced by Jack Nicholson, and everyone was trying to figure out how much of the movie was true and how much wasn't. And there was a lot of complaining that the movie was one-sidedness, and how dare you tell the story of a breakup of a marriage because of an unfaithful husband only from the wife's perspective. And I think if you look at that movie now, it's full of all of the things that made Mike Nichols a wonderful director. There's incredible attention to what we talked about earlier, which is, you know, expressing who a character is through little idiosyncratic choices and behaviors and brief lines and small physical actions. It's really observant about a whole social class of people. It's very funny. It's impeccably cast. Every performance in it is really sharp. And I think that's a movie that deserves a better reputation than it's had over the years. And I'm really happy that a lot of people are taking another look at it now because they've read about it in the book.
Yeah. And as you point out in the book, a stunning, from our perspective, level of misogyny in those reviews back then.
Right. I mean, it's really remarkable to see critic after critic, and some of these were very good critics, but they all sort of said the same thing, which was, well, there must have been a reason that this character cheated on her. She must have done something wrong. Or, well, it doesn't seem like much of a marriage. She's not very attractive. I mean, it was completely this perspective that if a marriage breaks up because of a husband's infidelity, it must be on some level the wife's fault. And it's really important for a movie to address that and acknowledge it. So those reviews would never be written today the same way. And to see the movie out from under that kind of perspective, I mean, I've been surprised at the number of people who've said to me, I've never seen Heartburn. I've always heard it was terrible. That thing really stuck to it, and it's taken a long time to get it unstuck.
He had such respect for writers. Did you witness that personally when he directed Angels in America?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Mike loved writers the same way he loved actors and film editors and theater production designers. He loved people who could do really well something that he couldn't do. What he was a great director, but that did not make him competitive with writers. So there's this long history of people from Neil Simon to Tony on Angels in America, but also Tom Stoppard, Nora Ephron, you know, people who really enjoyed collaborating with him, and he knew how to bring out the best in them too. I mean, doing Angels in America wasn't simply a matter of sort of retyping the play script. It had to be broken up into 6 1-hour installments, right. And certain things had to be eliminated. And Mike was a great, I think, advisory force to Tony on that production, and really is the person who convinced Tony that he could write a script.
I found the final chapters of the book and of Mike Nichols' life in many ways heroic. He had conquered a lot of demons, battled addiction, and seemed to have finally found joy in his personal life. And even with those physical struggles, was always looking forward to that next project right until the very end.
Yeah, I'm glad that you feel that way. I find them sort of heroic, too. There's something very moving to me about a man who has taken his entire life to figure out, decade after decade, how to become his best self. And he's finally in a place where he's very much at peace with his life. He's conquered his demons. He's getting to do the kind of work he wants to do. And at the same time, he realizes that time is short and time is precious, and that his physical stamina and his ability to do the kind of vigorous work that he wants to do is, you know, in his 70s and early 80s, seeping away a little bit. So in a way, the end of the book is both, I think, the story of a very well-fulfilled life and the story of a race against time.
And the book was so powerful and so moving, and for me personally, nowhere more so than in the epilogue and at the gathering to celebrate his life a year later that they called the Last Rat Pack. And you quote an actress, and this was the part where I just was so moved. An actress said, "How did he make all of us feel like we were the special one?"
Yeah, I think that's as beautiful a one-sentence summary of his technique as a director as anyone has offered. I mean, because it speaks to the way Mike conducted himself in his personal life, where he really, as someone said, you know, having him as a friend was like the sun shining on you. But also, it is very much about the way he worked as a director, which is that it wasn't just about saying the right thing to the leading man or the leading lady. It was about saying the right thing to someone who has three lines in a movie or in a play, just to make that person understand their place in the system and feel special for that minute. He knew how important that was, and he really knew how to do it.
Boy, and there's no better example I can think of in the book than when they're rehearsing Waiting for Godot, and he has the actors switch characters.
Right. Steve Martin and Robin Williams were the stars of Waiting for Godot and you know, really very, very, very famous at that point. And the two other parts were played by F. Murray Abraham and Bill Irwin, who are spectacular performers, mm-hmm. who, you know, who didn't have, you know, the level of celebrity that Williams and Martin had. And during a rehearsal one day, he just abruptly said, "Okay, now you two, you're going to be the leads. And Robin and Steve, you're going to play the supporting characters." And he did it. And I think Steve Martin in particular was quite impressed by what it showed them all about the play and about the roles. But at the end of that exercise, Mike turned to Steve Martin and Robin Williams and said, "See, it's not so easy, is it?" And I thought that was a great kind of democratizing moment. It was basically a way of saying, there are four actors on stage right now. They're not ranked. Everybody has their part to play. Everybody is an equal contributor to making this a success.
Well, you made Mike Nichols come to life so incredibly well. I felt like I knew him. I was brokenhearted at the end of his story, and I took my time reading it because I didn't want it to end. I was having such a wonderful ride along the way, and I was reading it on my iPad, so I had no idea how long the book was until the end. And I went, that's not possible. I thought this book was about 185 pages because it was such a joyride to get through, a really remarkable piece of research and craft and bringing Mike Nichols to life like I don't think anybody else could, Mark.
Well, thank you so much. That really means the world to me.
Well, I appreciate you making time for us today. Thanks so much, Mark, and be well.
You too. Thanks.